Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 401, and my guest today is the amazing Tim Renkow. This is one of my favourite conversations. I seem to be saying that a lot lately. I will concede it. But yeah, I really enjoyed chatting to Tim. I've been a fan of Tim. I stumbled upon his show Jerk on the BBC one night and ended up binging all of it on iPlayer. Series 2 has recently dropped on iPlayer. It's fantastic. Tim is a comedian, and he's great. He's a writer as well, and an actor, and all sorts of stuff. And his story's amazing. I really enjoyed this chat because it's inspirational, and I don't mean that in a condescending way. Tim happens to have cerebral palsy. You'll probably notice, in the same way that you'll notice I have a stutter. It comes up because I think it's heavily affected his amazing attitude in life, and you'll hear why. Yeah, so we'll get into the podcast. Before we do, thanks to everyone for all the birthday love and the 400th episode love. Obviously, we had episode 400 last week. It was the big birthday bash, Return to the Within. Myself, Chris and Stu returned to the iconic Within and had a few drinky drinks. And we also launched the 10-year anniversary of the Distraction Pieces album vinyl. It's a doubled disc white vinyl with an exclusive spoken word version of the album recorded in the woods at Stanley Park in Vancouver. I went up there all on my own and recorded in the woods. So yeah, that's all available at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Always is. I will also mention in this podcast, I mention a mate of mine who is on Twitch, who also happens to have cerebral palsy. And his name is Andrew Portis. You can find him Portessa is his Twitch. So Portis, P-O-R-T-E-S-S, and then A, Portessa. Let's get on with the chat with Tim, right? You're going to love this, and then you're going to, if you haven't already watched at least series one of Jerk, you're going to jump in and binge both of them, I think, as soon as we finish rambling on. Yeah, enjoy this. This is episode 401 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the legend, Tim Renkow. That scary voice shouting at me. Right, I'm here today with Tim Renkow. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. You were just telling me, the reason I wanted to rush into recording there is you were just telling me about another podcast.
Oh, yeah.
You just done where you got to tell a ghost story. Yeah. That sounds fucking amazing.
Super fun. So much fun.
And it's Spooktown, did you say it was called?
Yeah, Spooktown.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
So how's your lockdown and pandemic been?
It's been pretty great. I've always said I was antisocial, and this really put that to the test.
Yeah.
And I think I was right. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's worked out okay. Yeah. And have you grown your beard because of lockdown? Because I was sporting a beard beforehand,
no.
But your beard's as impressive as mine already.
Thank you. Yeah, no. I always rock the beard.
Yeah, it's looking good, man. So how's it been being an American in the UK in this last year or two? Because America's been doing some shit,
yeah.
Man. Some stuff's been going on. How's that been as a representative as such?
That's a very good question. It's not as intense as it would have been because you're not seeing anyone, so you don't need to defend yourself to anyone.
Yeah.
But it is stuff like my whole family's in the States, and like you call home, and after like a moderately tough day of lockdown, you call home and be like, how are you guys? And they would just be like, oh, the country's falling apart, how are you? And it's like, well, now I can't say anything, I'm fine compared to y'all.
Yeah, it's really hard. I found it with, I think in the last year or two, England has been really big on going a back and forth with America on who's making the stupidest choices. So anytime I'm like, oh, look what's going on in America, then England, Boris gets COVID or whatever else, or Brexit happens and all this other shit, and we're like, oh man, it's a tough contest.
It's very impressive. I just like I knew we would fall into totalitarianism eventually, just because that's the way of things. But I never thought totalitarianism would be so absurd.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and again, I completely feel you on that, because there's so much stuff in like bleak sci-fi films that I watched as a teen thinking, oh man, that's crazy. And then we get closer and closer and I'm like, I guess they kind of, I guess that kind of makes sense. I see how we got here now.
Yeah, they nailed it. God damn it. Yeah.
So as a kid, you moved around quite a bit. I was reading your born in New Mexico and then in North Carolina and then went to art school in Tennessee. How was that? How was your travels?
So good. I like moving. So I was actually born in Mexico. The OG Mexico, not the new
original Mexico, real Mexico.
My parents did that partly because if there was ever a draft, they wanted me to have dual citizenship. Because they're hippies and... But, like, looking back on it, never gonna be an issue for me.
Yeah, it turned out you swerved that regardless, I guess. Yeah. But still good to have dual citizenship, right?
Yeah, so... so I was born there, but I only lived there for, like, a year. And then I grew up in North Carolina, which... Have you been there?
No, I've never been to North Carolina. I've been to a lot of America, but no, never made it
it's
out.
It's a strange place because, like, there's, it's the deep south and all of that, but there's pockets of left-wing hippies dotted around. So, like, I grew up, like, in a very liberal bubble, you know, because my folks are hippies. And then when I became 18, so I lived my life not knowing, assuming my body's gonna break down at some point, but not knowing when. So I've just been going full throttle. So I wanted to get far away from my hometown as I could, but more like socially than geographically.
Yeah.
So I moved to, I decided to go to school in Memphis, which I fucking love it, but it's like, it's the most dangerous place I've ever lived by far. Really, especially at that point, like I was in the good part of town, and there was still gunshots every night, you know.
Wow.
But I just wanted to know what life was like for everyone.
Yeah, I love that, to push out and find those experiences. Do you think growing up with kind of hippie parents is what allowed you to want to push the boundaries of what you do? Because like comedy and the entertainment industry, where I grow up, that wasn't particularly put on as an option of careers. And then obviously adding your condition of cerebral palsy more and more wouldn't have said, oh, here's what you could do as a job. You could be a comedian and you could write and produce and act and do like these four things. So what drove you to go, I want to do these creative things. I want to study art. I want to study creative writing. I want to do all of these things.
So I really, like, my dream job, if I had my way and could do anything, would be a character designer for cartoons and video games. That's what I studied. That's what I really wanted to do. But then my hands just stopped working well enough to do it, you know. I was at a loss, but like partly actually because of the disability, I couldn't really do a 9-to-5. Like, you know, it's not an option. So there was a little music club bar like next to my house in Memphis, and they had a comedy competition one night, and I was like, well, I definitely can be on stage and talking to a microphone to see if that'll happen.
Yeah.
So I did that, and I was, the stand-up community in Memphis is tiny, and I was good, right? So I moved to New York within a year. Again, that thing about, right, let's go for it right now.
Yeah.
And it's funny when you're doing something in like a, Memphis isn't a small town, but the comedy community is small. And when you go from big fish in a small pond to a tiny fish in a huge pond that's not even good at comedy yet, like, you realize you're just not, not only are you not the best, you're not even that good, you're bad because you've only been going a year. So that was a shock, and it kind of drew me for loop. So I decided to visit here for 6 months.
Well, there's a few things I want to pick up on there, because, like, one of the things I love about your show Jerk, which we will get to, I promise, is your character Tim's desire to exploit his disability to his best advantage. And I was going to say, moving to New York, man, that's a deep pool of comedians. But you've definitely got something that's going to make you stand out, man. Like people are going to remember the comedian that had palsy. It's not just going to be another middle-aged white guy as such. There's loads of them. So do you feel that worked in your advantage at all? Or did you feel, as you said, it was too much of a small fish in too big a pond?
I think so. I've always been, like, the only thing I care about is being good. Like, that's all I care about, actually, more than success, more than anything. It's just being good at the job. And I didn't feel like I was good enough to use the disability. Like, I'm happy to use the disability to get on stage, but only if I feel like I can bring something once I got there.
Yeah, completely. It's no good using it to pull in attention if your jokes aren't up to standard anyway, because all of a sudden everyone's looking at you and you're like, I'm not that funny yet. I've still got work to do.
Yeah, and the other thing about being disability is you can get away. Like, I don't know if it don't make sense, but I could be worse and get away with it. Like, I could be worse than I want to be and get away with it, which I don't want to do. So there's,
I was going to say, does that motivate you and drive you to be better and better? Because you know that there might be some situations where if someone else was doing this, they'd be getting a harder ride from the audience.
And they should, like, the hard ride for women too good. Like, you know, so, yeah.
I love that. So how did you make the choice to come to the UK? Because, I mean, man, that's a big a choice. A friend of mine, Kaylin, is a rapper in a group called a Wheelchair Sports Camp, and her condition means that she has to have a wheelchair at all times. And she always complains that her travel wheelchair is shit compared to her at home wheelchair. So every time she's touring, it's just a nightmare. Yeah. What was the practicalities of going, right, I'm going to relocate not only over several states, I'm going to relocate to another country, and airlines having to not break shit and travel and all that kind of thing?
So it was again, it went back to them. My body can do this now. Yeah. I know I can do it now. I don't think I can wait. So let's just fucking go for it, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, but like it sucks. It's hard. Like it wasn't until last year I lived in a place that I could get a wheelchair into.
Wow.
So I would just
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like so like
man, that's intense.
I'm very lucky that one, I physically could do that, and two, I had a support system. Like my family's super tight. So it was not like I always had to fall back, which helps. Yeah. So.
I love that. And I love the outlook of rather than thinking, how tough is this going to be in the future, or this or that, going, yo, I can do it now. So let's fucking do it. Let's get on with it. Let's not hang about. Let's not mess around.
Yeah, because what's the worst that happens? I end up back in North Carolina on benefits, which would have happened anyway. So why not try, you know?
Yeah, I love that. So how was it on arriving in the UK? You were studying creative writing, right? But I assume the stand-up continuing? What was the deal?
Continuing, I think technically, illegally. which I didn't know at the time.
My first two or three tours of America were technically promo. Because I didn't have any actual legal right to be performing out there. It's like, no, it's just a promotional tour.
Yeah, it's so funny to do that. But yeah, so I did stand up here, and you actually get paid for doing stand up here, which you don't in the States.
Wow.
So it was kind of like, yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that's going to make a difference. Right. And how was this balancing it with study? How did that all level out?
My school was not good. So I got away with so much shit. I mean, I do think it was helpful because it was all grinding. So it was, it's very cross-pollinational disciplines that worked out. And I just am very, very good at bullshitting my way out of stuff. So, like, I did stuff. Like, I managed to convince my teachers to let me turn in my first Edinburgh show as my final thesis.
Oh, wow.
And then on top of that, I said that writing anything down would interrupt my process. So I just had to videotape it and send that in.
I love that. So the thing that you would have had to be trying to go, look, can I get some time off to go and do my Edinburgh show? Instead, you're going, oh, no, it's not time off. This is my project. This is what I'm handing in.
Yeah.
So how was that doing Edinburgh? Because Edinburgh is something that all of my American mates are blown away by, because at least for a long time, they just don't have that in America, where you're just in one place doing the same show night after night. You're not having to tour. That must have been good from a creative... I love it from a creative point of view, but from a condition point of view as well, knowing the room you're going to be in, not having, again, friends of mine who've got different disabilities, when they tour, the nightmare is always arriving at the venue and seeing bullshit they're going to have to overcome to get on stage. But being in the same venue night after night, that must have been awesome, right?
That's good. I mean, but that's counterbalanced by being you're in Edinburgh, which is
Oh yeah.
It is. I think it's a city specifically designed to tell me personally to fuck off.
Like, yeah, I think you could be right. As soon as you said that, I was like, oh shit, yeah, Edinburgh's not convenient.
No, but like, so I love performing that much. Like, you can easily do 3 hours a night if you want, which, I mean, you'll just get so much better so quickly. So I love that. I don't like how much, I feel like Edinburgh has really, like, warped stand-up into more of a theater show type thing, which, I'm a club guy. I like performing in clubs, and it's a totally different beast. And so,
how do you find that on the club point of view? How do you find it when you've got slots and a set time to fill? Because I used to do a lot of spoken word, and I've got a stammer, and I'd kind of find, like, if I've gone over my 5 minutes, I could be like, well, it was 5 minutes when I wrote it. You know, it may not have taken me 5 minutes because I took longer tonight. How do you find that in the restrictions of getting a piece in when you're also, you know, that's like, it could vary how long it takes each time.
That's a good question. I'm lucky in that respect because my speaking is, it's weird. The impediment is weird, but this is solid, you know, so I it's not like it's spelled out real. I'm like, I don't know if it's gonna take 2 seconds or 5 minutes to get out this one. Yeah. I know the amount of time I'm gonna be speaking and how many words I can get in.
Yeah.
And, which, granted, is a lot fewer words than most people. But I can plan. It's not like gonna throw me that much that often.
Yeah. So what is it about clubs you prefer to the fringe kind of one person show thing?
It goes back to just wanting to be good. Where the more you get an audience, the more you can just kind of coast.
Yeah.
And I just don't want to coast. I like going against a new group of people that don't know what the fuck's gonna happen and try to win it over. Just keeps it interesting for me.
I completely agree. I remember seeing the first 2 times I saw Doug Stanhope.
Yeah.
One was at his show, and it's kind of the thing that it was almost ruined because part of Doug's appeal is the way he will shock.
Yeah.
And then bring it back round and things like that. But when it's his crowd, there's no way of shocking. The second time I saw him was at the Pimm's Comedy Festival. So it was incredibly middle-class white people, and people were walking out during his show. And that's what I wanted to see of Doug Stanhope, was that kind of... He then won loads of people over because, again, the nature of his sets will be... You'll think he's going in one direction, and by the end, it's the exact opposite. But, yeah,
cause
I get that, not coasting on your own crowd or everyone knowing what to expect.
I realised it when I saw him. I was brand new, and I saw Eddie Izzard doing new stuff. And it was new, right? So some of it was clunky, but he was getting laughs. Every single punchline. And it's like, you could see he knew the jokes didn't land.
Yeah.
And he was good enough that, I mean, he's good enough that he knows, but, like, it just makes it so much harder to be good if people like
you. Yeah, yeah, I completely understand that. They're already invested in laughing at whatever you say.
Yeah.
So they're almost laughing at the cadence as much as the actual words in the joke and in the rhythms.
Because also, like, when you hear it easy to somebody, people define themselves by liking you. So if you say something they don't like, it fucks with their own perception of themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. So, I mean, speaking of the joy of comedy clubs then, comedy clubs, particularly in London, are one of the last areas that 100% have not got on board with accessibility, with all sorts of other shit. They're so regularly in the attic of a pub or in the basement of a nightclub or whatever else. So how's that side of it? How is the turning up to work and being like, right, here's what I need to get through? I guess in that situation, being on a walker rather than on wheels is handy, but...
Oh, yeah, it's a lifesaver. I don't know how you do it on wheels, but, like, because it's not, like, I understand that it's frustrating and stuff, but on the other hand, it's kind of what keeps it. One, it keeps it cheap. That you can do it anywhere, and it keeps it unregulated in a way that wouldn't be if it had to be in like a theater. Mm-hmm. But like I just don't know what to do about it because it's annoying, but also I don't want to change it.
Yeah, I completely understand. This is an absolute nightmare, but it's kind of exactly how I want it to be. I'll deal with it. So how do you go from doing comedy clubs in London, a creative writing course that you've blagged into the end of year piece being your Edinburgh show, to having a show, Jerk, on the BBC? Like, I remember just clicking over, not knowing what it was, and just being and falling in love with it. What was the journey there?
That is an excellent question. So my buddy was is a producer, and he was applying for a job, and part of the application was he had to write a fake treatment. So he called me up and he said, do you mind if I just write one about you? The shit thing, and I thought, I don't care. And he did it, and very keenly, he did not get the job. So he didn't get the job, but he was like, "Hey Tim, actually, I like this. Do you want to actually try to do this?" And I went, "Yeah, I got nothing else going." So we did it, and he got it into the Blap, which is like a 15-minute short. And I thought, oh, that's fun. That'll be a story to tell my grandkids. I got a Blap. And then it got picked up, and I thought, oh, that's fun. That'll be a story to tell my grandkids. I got one show one time. And then it got picked up for a second season. I'm like, okay, cool. I guess this is a thing now.
It's mad, right? It's a hell of a journey. So, again, like, I love the fact that most things, because I get this with my stammer. I've had a load of things where people say, oh, it's brave of you to do a podcast or to do a radio show or to rap or to do acting, all these other things. But in reality, I just didn't think about it until it was happening. And then everyone's like, man, that was brave. I'm like, oh, shit. Yeah, I guess I just hadn't thought about it. And it feels exactly the same with you, that you've just gone, cool, and not thought about the work it will be or how stressful it might be or tiring it might be. And then, all right, cool, let's do it.
It turns out it's very hard to write a show. Who knew?
Yeah, exactly.
It's also funny. I think I'm kind of picking up your stammer.
It does. It gets contagious. Yeah. I always find if I'm talking to other people who've got a stammer at all, then we're just at the worst. It goes on and on.
It's like, I met two best friends with Tourette's. And they right. set each other up. It was so funny.
Amazing. So, I mean, how was it then to go, right, I've got to write a show. And the first season was four parts, and it's all based around you, your character potentially being deported because of his visa yeah. running out. Once again, thinking up a blap, yeah, I can yeah. do that. And then thinking up a show and going, right, yeah. I've got the story, it's four episodes or whatever else. And then going, oh, you've got yeah. another series. How's that all been in the creative? Has there been imposter syndrome yeah. or panic?
I mean, always imposter syndrome. I live my life in imposter syndrome. But like, so it was hard because, believe it or not, blacking me away through a creative writing course does not make you good at creative writing. So it was like we couldn't do it. So we got a guy named Sean Pye in to write, like the head writer.
Yeah.
I don't know if you did him, if you know him, but he's amazing. And watching him write has been, or not even watching, just learning how to write from him has been yeah. the best experience ever. Because I always enjoyed writing, but I never felt like I had a teacher, a writing teacher that cared enough to actually get on my ass about stuff, but he yeah. does. And so it's just been like I kind of been looking at it as like graduate school in a way.
Yeah.
Like, it's just been so cool to learn how to construct a story. And yeah. like writing is my favorite part. Like yeah. so.
I love it. I love that you did a creative writing course, and what actually broke through to you was working yeah. with a writer that you were excited about and understood, and he understood you. And
I think actually that's like the good thing about writing courses is they make you write.
Yeah.
But that's kind of all they can do. Like
yeah.
if I did it again, I think I would have studied psychology, because writing's just about practice. But yeah, yeah, so
how was it then going on to make Jerk? Because again, you've spoken about you tend to not think too much ahead of time of how exhausting or how painful or whatever things are going to be. Were there any kind of things that you wrote that you then had to actually go out and do, and it was a nightmare?
Oh God, yes, everything. But the one that stands out the most is this weird correlation of the shorter the stage direction, the more painful doing it is.
Yeah.
So, I'd say the worst thing I wrote that I had to do was the line, "We see Tim eating a curry." That's right. Like that line, and you see that, and you think, ah, it's okay, that'll be fine. But what you don't realize until you start performing is that means you're going to take about 50 bites of cold curry.
Yeah.
Like cold curry that the color wasn't right for the director. So the props people just poured ketchup in. So it was curry and ketchup, and you're like vomiting by the end of the day.
I completely feel that. There's so many things that seem like it's going to be the best day, and then it's not. I was doing a film in France a while back, and we had a day where my character was eating pizza with people, and I was like, I love pizza.
Yeah.
Let's eat pizza constantly. But as you said, it was cold pizza. And then on that day, I don't know why they planned it like this, on that day, as a treat for lunch, they'd got a pizza van in to give everyone pizza. And I'm like, pizza's literally my favourite thing, but I've just eaten cold pizza. And then my character had to throw it up as well. So I was like, the last thing I want anything to do with is pizza right now. But again, you see it on paper and think, yeah, let's do this. So I can completely imagine he eats curry, or we see him eating curry. Yeah. You're like, all right, cool. Hi. Let's do that. But
I mean, yeah, I did a thing with pizza this season.
Yeah.
Pizza's bad, but curry's worse, I think.
Yeah, I can completely imagine it is. How are the days on set? Because I know, because TV is something that you don't have the luxury of time. Yeah. You know what I mean? They tend to just want to get it all done as quickly as possible, loads of states. And that is exhausting for anyone.
Yeah.
How have you found it with balancing it with your condition and how you might feel in general and being a writer on it as well? How does that all, how is that filming period? Do you then need a load of time off to fucking get your head together and recover?
So I probably should take time off, but I was like, I'm on a roll. Let's just keep this going for as long as I can. So, like, it is physically exhausting, but, like, Edinburgh was also helped with this in that, like, I find this a piece in my brain I can just shut off until it's over. Right. And then collapse at the end. So this season, I wrote me sitting down a lot more. Like, I was like, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
So, but like this season, there was a couple really, really brutal days. Like there was one day where me and Lost Voice Guy have to race around a track. And I don't know why, but we did it on the coldest day in May. So we were all just dying. But like, you get a good night's sleep and you try not to think about it too much.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned there, a lot of people know a Lost Voice Guy from Britain's Got Talent, Lee Ridley. You've also got Rob Madding from the Brett Domino trio in it as well. How was that kind of filling the cast up with other comedians, but also having, you know, a representation in there for different disabilities, different body types and looks and all sorts of stuff?
So, I mean, last boy, we didn't actually think about it that much. Last Boy's Guy was the only character that I wrote specifically for him because he's the nicest man on the face of the planet. So I wanted to make him an asshole because...
Perfect.
Because why not? Disabled people never get to be assholes. And I knew he would like the opportunity. And then, so, Rob, I had no idea who he was because Brett Domino kind of had him before I was here. But he's great. Like, just really fun to play, talk about music with. Really fun to talk about music with. And then Sharon, the lady that plays Ruth, is just by far the best actress I've ever seen. So it's like, and also she was like, I haven't had this since I was about 7. But she came into the, like, casting room and I just saw each other and we did that thing that 5-year-olds do where they just walk up to each other and go, okay, we're friends now.
Like, yeah.
The chemistry was just on there immediately. So
I love it. You said something there that disabled people never get to be arseholes or get to play arseholes. And that's what's great about a Lost Voice guy's character and your character, because representation isn't about always playing this wonderful hero or this sympathetic hero. It's about layers and varied and complicated characters. And it's what I love about Jerk is you're not just going, look, here's a comedy show and the lead guy's got a condition and it's all very serious. It's like, no, he's got a condition. He's going to abuse that condition. He's going to use it. He's going to do whatever he can. He's going to be a dick at points. Like, how important was that to go, right, we don't want to just tick any boxes here?
Yes, that's very important to me. Because my whole thing is, when you deify people like people do to disabled people, it's kind of the same as turning them into monsters, because you're taking away the humanity. So my thing is, I just want to portray disability as human more than anything, and humans are not good.
I love that. That's such a... I took my phone out then to make a note, because we do little quote videos, and that's so beautifully put, that when we deify people with disability, it's the same as making them into monsters, because again, it's not giving a realistic portrayal or giving anything like that. I love that. So how series 2 been? What's the kind of the theme of series 2? Because as said, series 1 was all about will he or won't he get deported, and we've solved that mystery. So what's the plan?
So series 2, we didn't really plan it this way, but it does seem to be a never-ending quest to try to get high, which wasn't really the plan, but it just happened that way. So I think at some point he tries to get his hands on any drug he can and just keeps fucking it up for himself, because he can't play the game long enough to make people like him.
I love it. So I mean, outside of comedy, outside of TV, what do you enjoy doing? Because again, like, this pandemic has really made a lot of people have to face and figure out what they like doing. Again, I'm similar. I'm one that see myself as a bit of as very much an introvert, as very much a staying at home guy. But even those have been tested in this period. So what is your time filler?
So I really like writing. It's my favorite thing to do. So I've been trying to write a comic book with my friend Sam Golan, so that's been how I've been spending most of my time. But also, like, because I realized I like writing now, I have to go back and do, like, all the work that people should do before they get their own TV series.
Yeah. You've got to find a balance, though, because you don't want to take off the rawness that you have, the things that make you such a good voice in this. But I'm completely the same. I got acting gigs before I'd done any acting training, and all the feedback was, it's because you don't feel like you've gone to drama school. But then a few acting gigs on, I'm like, but I should do some kind of classes, right? I should find out some advice and read some books on it and that kind of thing. So,
and I think you meet people that are really good actors, and you're like, I mean, yeah, but they went to drama school.
Yeah.
So there's something.
Yeah, it's getting the balance, I guess, isn't it? So are you a big comic book guy? Do you read a lot of comics? Like, or what kind of things are you into?
So right now I'm reading The Boondocks.
Yep.
And Chew.
Yeah.
I'm a weirdo, because I love comic books, but I don't like superheroes.
It's I mean, that's the beauty of a lot of the independent
comics,
or almost everything on Image really seems to be just they put out loads of dope smaller stuff, Irish stuff, English, American, and all sorts. There's good stories in there.
Yeah, so I'm really liking Chew.
Yeah, I'm not familiar
with
it.
Have you read Chew?
No.
It's about a guy with powers that he can see how you died if he eats a piece of you.
Wow.
So it's all about the police forcing him to eat people.
Oh, man, that's amazing. I love that shit.
Yeah, no, it's good. Yeah, but, like, just... I just like the way... So, because of how my head shakes, I can only read about 20 words at a time before my vision goes blurry. So growing up, the only thing, literally the only thing I physically could read was comic books.
Yeah. It's amazing, though, because you grew up at a perfect time where comic books were moving away from just being a kid's thing. They were getting some, like, from The Watchmen onwards, they were kind of being respected as these amazing stories and pieces of literature. So that's kind of perfect timing in that respect, I guess.
The first book I remember sneaking from my parents was Mouse.
Yeah.
Like, my parents didn't want me to read Mouse. I snake snuck into it.
I love it.
Had to hide it in my...
I love that, having to sneak and hide it as if it's a porno or whatever else. It's just, I just want to read it, man. Just hook me up.
Yeah. I get not wanting an 8-year-old to read about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
But it was just like, oh, I don't have to read about Superman.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't care about it.
there's a whole variation out there. And what kind of, I will wrap things up in a minute, I promise, but what kind of music are you into? You mentioned enjoying talking to Rob about music. What's your go-to?
Yes, so I mean, recently it's been a lot of rap. Ever since MF Doom died, it's pretty much been only MF Doom for like...
All Doom all day.
Months and months and months.
But Doom's got the intricacy in there to do that. Like, you can listen and you'll be finding stuff a year on that you didn't hear first time.
I have to listen to each of his songs about 5 times before I get them.
Yeah.
So I really like him. I really like I cannot say this guy's name. Sweatshirt.
Yeah.
So all those underground ASAP Rock.
Yep.
All those underground guys I like, so that and a lot of folk murder ballads.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so.
I love that. It seems you're drawn to those ones that are telling stories, have got that intricacy, because Aesop's another one. There's tracks that I've listened to and 10 years on, I've found stuff in Daylight or whatever else. I was like, oh, I never quite twigged that's what he was saying, because it's so dense, and the density can be so hard to get through as you're listening to just bump along. But yeah, and murder ballads again, stories.
I really, really like stories.
Yeah.
Every time I'm about to get sappy, my comedian brain comes in and goes, don't do that, you fucking pussy-ass piece of shit. But I do feel like stories are the only thing that kind of matter.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care about much else.
Yeah.
And I want stories that I cannot relate to.
Yeah.
Like MF Doom, That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
I do not understand. Like, I have not lived through it at all.
I remember that in my kind of late teens, early 20s, finding all the stuff on the Def Jux and Rhymesayers and Strange Famous, and just feeling such a connection to it in that exact same way. Although it isn't the life I live at all in my small town in Essex, there's so much I can relate to in the same way. I've always said the reason I connected with rap was because I grew up on punk, and hearing rap, I was like, oh, this is another community's version of punk. This is the voice of the voiceless again. So there was that instant shorthand of like, right, I don't know that exact story, but I've lived my version of it as such.
Yeah, it's funny because you were actually like, there were a few people that like, I had them and I was like, oh, I want to move here. Like, Dylan Warren.
Yeah.
The comedian. Who's my favorite comedian. But Distraction Pieces was also one of the...
Oh, wicked, man.
I was like, okay, let's check out England.
Oh, I appreciate that, man. That blows my mind. I love that shit.
Yeah. I don't even... Because I found it through Stage Francis.
Distraction Pieces was a big one for me in America because I had Sage and Dolan and POS and like Travis Barker all on it. So it meant all these American acts that it kind of gave me a channel into, I guess.
It might have been POS.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
Because they were like... I used to have one of my favorite lines, which is I saw a fish on the pavement and I thought, what did you expect? There's no water here, stupid. Should have stayed where it was wet.
Yes, mate.
I just love calling a fish stupid.
Yeah, genuinely, I didn't say all of that, but I did. Where I'm sitting now in my living room, within sight, is the bit of road I was walking along, and I literally saw a dead fish on the pavement, and that's where that line came from. That I kind of, obviously, I then took it off in this weird way, but yeah.
So I found you in Memphis when I was starting out, because I was just I wasn't a rap guy before comedy, because I was into like heavy metal because of where I grew up and stuff, and that's my voice of the voiceless of the deep south. But I was just trying to figure out how to use words.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, these guys know how to string a sentence together.
Yeah, man.
So it's, I
love that. Well, I'm glad we got to have this conversation. As said, I've been enjoying your work for a while now, so it's a nice surprise at the end there to hear that you had any clue who I was. So that's always an honour, man. That's always an honour.
Yeah.
So what's ahead, I guess? Obviously, you've got Series 2. Are you excited to get him back to being in the clubs? Because just before the pandemic, you had your one-man show at the Soho Theatre, and then, everything stopped. So are you buzzing to get back?
No.
You tried really hard to pretend you were buzzing to get back for a second there, didn't you? Then went, nah.
I'm just not good at lying. the thing is, I've just been enjoying writing scripts so much that it's like, it's scratched that itch for me, and it means I don't need to spend my time staring at drunk people.
Yeah.
And trying to corral them. So, but like, I think, because I have my first gig on Wednesday, I think once I do it, I'll be like, oh yeah, I like.
Yeah, here's what it is. I'm back.
Yeah. I just enjoy driving.
Yeah.
And sleeping. You forget how good it is to be in bed by 10.
Yeah. Not having to be out and doing all these other things.
Yeah.
I completely feel you, though. I genuinely stopped touring and doing music to try acting out. And then after acting for a bit, I started working on scripts. And I've not missed touring at all. Is it like I expected to? I expected after a year to get a bit itchy, but exactly the same. The writing and the creativity scratches that itch, but it's a weird one because it's not one that has instant gratification. It's long term. Yeah. There's not, like for you, there's not that laugh in front of you as you come up with it. That's all in your own head that you're just like, this is dope. Like, this is really funny. I've written something really good here.
Yeah.
But it's a weird one to convert. Yeah.
So,
well, thank you for taking the time, man. As said, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I'm excited for series two.
Yeah, it's fucked up. I got God plays guitar in it.
Amazing.
I was really happy with that.
I can't wait.
I really want a musical episode because he's so good at music.
Yeah.
And Shailene's a good singer too. Like, just like, if I had known you guys were going to be in it, it'd have been a lot more musical.
Exactly. Well, that means we just need a series three then, so you guys can work towards a musical episode.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, man. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Tim Renkow. I hope you enjoyed that as much as the both of us did. I got proper caught off guard again. It doesn't happen regularly, but every now and then I'll have a guest reveal that they kind of know who I am or into my music or whatever, and it always catches me off guard. And Tim, earlier on in the conversation, had dropped a few rappers that I'm a fan of. So I was like, yeah, this is good. But I still wasn't expecting him to say, and also, I dig your shit. So that was a lovely surprise. As I said, go and check out Jerk. It's fantastic. I'll be back next week. I think I'm going to have two episodes next week. I'm flooding you with episodes at the moment now. Obviously, there were four episodes of the big birthday bash. Then we got this with Tim. Then next week, I reckon I've got two for you. I'm not certain. I've not decided completely, but I reckon we might do a Monday and a Wednesday. And then we'll try and ease back into regular programming. Christ almighty. All right. I will talk to you all next week. Until then, stay sane and stay safe. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.